Because I have been in Israel, and I have lectured in Jerusalem, and I have met many of the men associated with the Dead Sea Scrolls, and been in the caves, and seen the documents, and studied them, I've also been able to find some interesting things concerning the fulfillment, where the Book of Mormon is concerned, of the restoration to the Jews, and some activities surrounding that restoration. So I thought tonight I'd share with you, in the few moments that remain, some of the things that have developed, and which I know personally about, that I'm sure you'll find of interest. Have any of you been in Jerusalem in the last 2 or 3 years? Any of you at all? That's an experience that is being made available now through the BYU tours, by the way. Brother Ludlow and Brother Skousen and others regularly conduct tours for adults to the Holy Land, 40 and 50 at a time. And that'd be an excellent way to encounter and really be able to go a few places where the events that are written up in scriptures transpired. If I were to be asked, where was the most spiritual place I ever found when I was in the Holy Land, I think I would respond from my personal experiences at a place called Bethany. I have walked from the Mount of Olives down to Bethany, and from Bethany over the mountain where Christ would have walked on his way to Jerusalem that fateful week. And those stones and that particular path is probably almost exactly as it may have been at his time. Other places have been buried by silt and rubble and everything, but those old rocks from Bethany over are still pretty well intact. And the reason why I believe that is one of the places that most spiritually influenced me, because of all the places that I was there, none of the places had the feeling of serenity and spirituality as the Garden of Bethany, because there Christ was loved. All the other places he was derided, criticized, and driven. But in Bethany, there were those who loved him. About 5 years ago, they established a branch in Jerusalem. In 1845, there was a proclamation made by the church and sent to all the governors and all the rulers and all the nations and all the states and everything throughout the world. And in it, two different places pointed out that the Jews are commanded to return to Jerusalem to build up, to be restored, to have their judges, their rulers, and their principals, and to rebuild their temple. Now, in the 124th section of Doctrine and Covenants, it says there will be temples built, and a temple will be built in Old Jerusalem where work for the dead can be done. Now, people miss that, but that's what will happen there. Well, when the branch was set up, they were commissioned to do three things, the branch presidency: to witness. He was in, I think, the first counselor, was specifically assigned, along with the others, to get the Book of Mormon into Hebrew, to get the testimony of Joseph Smith into Hebrew, and to find an information center for the church. Now, those were pretty large orders in preparation for the work that would go among the Jews. Now, officially, 1964 has been declared the year of the Lamanites, even though the work today is fulfilling that same proclamation that the whole Western Hemisphere would be alive with the growth and development of the Indians. And their growth is really occurring now. We would be the instrument of their literacy, their development, and their reentry into the church and their knowledge of their inheritance. And this is what's happening now with all the great growth. Then there would be the time of the Gentiles, and then that would come to an end. Even though work would not come to an end, there would be certain critical things that would transpire, which date could be put on them. And so a year ago, the day before conference, the day of the Gentile was proclaimed at an end and the work for the Jews to begin. In Las Vegas, there was a young man who had been converted to the church 13 years ago. 5 years ago, he moved to Salt Lake, and then he was called to be in the committee to prepare the material to take the word of the gospel to the Jews. In his patriarchal blessing, he had been told he would do that. On October last year, he came to Las Vegas and I spent 6 hours with him. He had finished the work the previous Monday. This was a Wednesday. Delivered it to the president of the Quorum of 12 and Bruce McConkie. And then on the 19th of November, went before the final details, and now it has been published and is being now utilized to take the gospel to the Jews. Part of it here in Southern California. Then it'll be moving in the spring into the Newhall area. And today the Articles of Faith are published with the Star of David and the Moroni on them. The first lesson has to do with there has been a prophet. A prophet has come. The second lesson, he has seen the Messiah. And the third lesson, the Messiah is Jesus Christ. Well, let's go back to that first one. A prophet has come. Do you know that among the Jews that there is a tradition of a Ben Berakiah who would come? A forerunner, Among the Dead Sea Scrolls, they found a fragment in Cave 4. It was rather startling. Dr. Starkey and Dr. Fitzmyer, working on it, read it as this: "I shall send you Elijah before, but it's not what you would think would be. It's something else." Starkey remarks about the cryptic fragment, mention the sending of Elijah before are tantalizing, says Fitzmyer. "If what he says is true, then this tiny fragment in Cave 4 preserves the earlier hint of a late Jewish belief in Elijah as the forerunner of the Messiah. Starkey identifies him with the eschatological prophet. There would be a forerunner who would be a prophet who would come before the Messiah, to whom Elijah would appear on Passover Day." And the same context, he says, speaks of the Essenes of Pompeian period, in other words, the Dead Sea Scroll people, 61 B.C., expecting their only Messiah and his forerunner. Now, in another document called The Elect of God, reflecting again the vision of Enoch, which talks about the elect of God and he who would come in the last days, says this: "In his youth, he will become like a man who does not know anything until the time when he shall become skilled in three books. Then he will become wise and will be endowed with discretion, and visions will come to him on his knees." Now, John the Baptist began his work on the Jordan, 6 miles north of this community of Qumran. So they run out from Jerusalem. "John, are you Elijah?" "No." "Are you the prophet?" He says, "No, I'm not that prophet." "He's the voice who crieth in the wilderness," says John. "John wasn't skilled in three books. He didn't have visions on his knees. An angel came to him and told him what to do." And then this person who will have visions on his knees and be skilled in three books and in his youth will become like a man who does not know anything, and then will suddenly have all these things. "With him there will be counsel and prudence. He will know the secrets of man, and his wisdom will go forth to all the peoples. He will know the secrets of all living beings. All their calculations against him will come to naught, although the opposition to him of all living beings will be great. But his calculations will succeed because he is the elect of God. And his birth and the very spirit of his breath and his calculations will exist forever." Who is he? And then 13 other documents, partially found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, translated by a Jewish scholar, Dr. Schoenfield, in England years ago, 20 years ago. And then a book called He That Cometh by Malwinkle, which describes the legend of the Ben Berechiah who would come, to whom Elijah would appear on Passover Day, and he would be from Ephraim. And then 13 documents say this in common. All of these vanished by the second century. "In his youth he would be filled with the Holy Ghost. He would be the restorer of priesthood. He would gather the elect from all the nations, and he would restore God's favor to the Jews before the destruction of Jerusalem. And then he would be killed by lawless men with another, and his blood would cry for vengeance from the ground. And in all these documents, his name would be Joseph." Now, the head of the community of Qumran was called Asaph, which is the Hebrew form of Joseph. And they thought he was the Joseph because he was the one who was going to be the forerunner. He actually predicted the coming of the Messiah, totally prepared for the coming of Christ. There's even a whole book I have up here that describes the details and how exactly he pinpointed the coming of Christ, just like Samuel in the Book of Mormon. But that Joseph of that community of Qumran died of old age, and they knew he was not the Joseph to come. Maybe we can bear witness to the world that it's our Joseph who came. He may be the Joseph. Because Joseph Smith did send, in 1841, a Jewish apostle, Orson Hyde, who he had confirmed in 1830. In 1830, he says, "Orson, you're going to be the instrument in the hands of the Lord to dedicate the land for the return of the Jews." And then Joseph, in 1841, called Orson Hyde in conference in April to go to Jerusalem and, in 1840, I should say, and dedicate the land for the return of the Jews. Now, Orson Hyde had just had a six-hour vision a short period before then of exactly what he was going to do, who he was going to see, and everything. He was going to go alone. And they put John Page with him to go on this mission. But John Page apostatized from the church by the time they got to New York, and Orson Hyde went alone. When he arrived in Jerusalem on that October morning of October the 24th, 1841, he went upon the Mount of Olives, and he built a little altar. Then he described his vision. Then he wrote the prayer. And that was one of the first things Joseph Smith wanted to see when he came back. And Orson Hyde visited him every night for several days after he came back. Orson Hyde didn't complain hardly of anything, except he didn't have enough snails to eat on the trip. Now, that little vision and the prayer of Orson Hyde has had an interesting history. In 1841, Orson Hyde reflected there were about 5,000 Jews in the vicinity, in the Jerusalem area and in Palestine. This you must know, The great dispersion of the Jews, and there were four, but the great one was in the year 68 to 70 A.D. The community of Qumran, the priests of Qumran, who probably joined the Christian church, because in Cave 7 they found many Christian fragments, and that's a big controversy they're still working on. That group of individuals, 6 miles south of Jericho, were destroyed by the Romans of the Roman 10th Legion. In the summer of 68 and 69, Titus of the Roman 10th Legion, his father being Vespasian of all Rome, killed 1,110,000 Jews in Jerusalem alone in 134 days. Then he massacred another 900,000, took 100,000 young men on a forced march back to Rome. None survived. Every boy and girl under the age of 17 were sold as slaves until they didn't even bring as much as a horse. And he took 6,000 over to Corinth to start the Corinthian Canal. He reduced the total Jewish population of Palestine to 8,000, and it stayed that or less for 1,900 years. Many of them, of course, not massacred, were driven from the country. That was the dispersion of the Jews. And every year they would say, next year in Jerusalem, the Seder, which they just said a few weeks ago. Today they're in Jerusalem. How did they get there? And what opposition occurred? This was the startling thing that I found in Jerusalem. Anyway, Tevetness had been told to get a place for the information in the center of the church. So he made a beautiful scroll and put in Hebrew the prayer of Orson Hyde, then in English, put it on a beautiful parchment that looked just like a scroll, and took it in to Teddy Kolchek, who on the ministerial level, and now of all the Jews, is the mayor of Jerusalem after 1,900 years. What a tremendous office. What a tremendous situation. Teddy Kolchek is a huge man. Tevetness is a little tiny man. And he laid that down on the desk, Tevetness did, and when Teddy Kolchek took a look at it, he rolled it up and he gave it back and he says, I don't want that. And he stood up, he said, I've got it memorized. And that's when we come to find out that General Diane and others had had the prayer of Orson Hyde memorized for 20 years. President Benson knew about that. He mentions it in his special beautiful article in the Ensign a few months ago. He knew about it. Ben-Gurion had it memorized. And Teddy said, then what do you want? Well, today now they're working on the details for an information center of the church that'll be placed near the Damascus Gate, maybe a second one in Bethlehem. And this winter a dependent branch was established in Galilee. And the first two baptisms were Arabs. But the temple work has got to be done for the Arabs as well as for the Jews. So there will be a uniting under priesthood of an opposition among peoples. And then what about the Book of Mormon into Hebrew? Just before Joseph Fielding Smith died, Brother Ludlow got a call on the phone, and a person wanted to sell him some portions of the Book of Mormon in Hebrew. He's on the translating committee, Brother Ludlow is, with Neininger. And so he purchased it, and he went in to see President Smith. And when President Smith saw it, he says, thank you for returning stolen property, took it from Brother Ludlow and put it in a drawer and shut it up and dismissed him. When he passed away, Brother Ludlow, remembering that, went to Bruce McConkie to see if they couldn't get it. Maybe there was more of it there. And it had been willed to the First Presidency of the Church. Now, it was Harold B. Lee who had commissioned them to get the Book of Mormon into Hebrew. So they got a letter, dashed back to Bruce McConkie, and got him to open up the safe. And in the safe was the entire Book of Mormon in a form of Yiddish Hebrew by a Jewish individual, Miller, who had been converted to the church in the 20s. And so they had a copy of that, but inside the safe was also the seer stone and some other things that had been held in the possession of Joseph Fielding Smith. Well, then, in Israel in the meantime, Tevetness and Galbraith had been trying to get the testimony of Joseph Smith translated into Hebrew, and they were having difficulties, even though both of them teach Hebrew, because the subtleties of that glory of the Father and the Son appearing to Joseph Smith required all kinds of intricacies. There had been a man who, against all opposition, impelled and motivated as men are today to do a great thing, had tried to resurrect Hebrew as a spoken language and get new grammars and new dictionaries and everything. Ben Yehuda. Streets are named after him and everything now. A whole book has been written on his life. Do you realize that in 1916 they just about adopted German as the national language of the Jews? What a catastrophe that would have been. At any rate, Hebrew was finally adopted and used, and there was only one or two men that could really get it into a fine situation. They found after repeated references that a man called Shinari, an officer, or at least a military member of the Air Force, could do the work. He helped them with the testimony of Joseph Smith. It was published and 30,000 copies arrived in Jerusalem a year ago last October. Then they had to work on the Book of Mormon. They tried to get him to help them with the translation. He said no, he wouldn't have time. But as soon as they had this book by Miller, they rushed it to Jerusalem. It arrived in January. I was there in February, I think. And Shinari took a look at it and said he would accept. And then they had to get some money for him, and that arrived about the day after I left. Shinari finished the Book of Mormon 2 months ago and fully translated now. He and his mother came to BYU a year ago last August. They were given 2 years to complete it. And you ought to hear his lectures now on what he knows concerning the idioms and the things of the Book of Mormon. There are the dissidents and those unfortunate individuals, unhappily in the obsessions that they have in their lives, that they think that the changes in the Book of Mormon are in some manner, shape, or form a deterrent. If you remember that the handwritten copy of the Book of Mormon dictated by Joseph Smith was without punctuation, and there isn't any in ancient Hebrew, and it had all kinds of strange problems, and it took 14,800 changes to correct it. And the Book of Mormon you got today is filled with those changes, so you can read it. But most of those changes, as Twetness bore witness in Jerusalem, almost all of them go back into perfect Hebrew. So now the Book of Mormon is available in Hebrew. The lessons are available to go to the Jews, and the work among the Jews will now occur. But let's go back a little bit further. Something catastrophic happened. The great dispensation of the fullness of times occurs in 1820. Of all things that were to happen, something was going on in Germany. When I was in Jerusalem, I acquired this book, The Return to Zion, written by the Jews, and another one which I have here called The Tents of Jacob, The Dispersion. And how shocked I was to realize what had happened. In 1819, they issued in Hamburg, the German Jews, the Ashkenazi. There are three great groups of Jews in the world, the Oriental Jews, which comprised maybe about a fourth of the population of the Jews, maybe a third, and the Sephardi, who were in Spain and then depossessed by the Muslims and the Moors and driven into Turkey and Greece and several other places, and then the Ashkenazi Jews, who are mostly European and part of the Eastern Central European. But in 1819, they issued a proclamation. Now realize this. Just a year later, the dispensation of the fullness of time is to be restored, and already on earth is there Joseph ben Berechiah alive as a young man. And 1 year later, he's going to kneel in a sacred grove and receive the show of glory. Another document talks about here in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and have a restoration that will return them to their land. And what do they do in Hamburg? They say, we will delete from all of our prayer books all reference of returning to Jerusalem. We will not go back. We shall not rebuild the temple. We will not be the people of God. And then in 1883, another group of the Ashkenazi and also the Reformed Judaism issue the same platform. It's called the Pittsburgh Platform, issued 1885, expressed the same reform. We consider ourselves no longer a nation, just a religious community, and therefore expect neither a return to Palestine nor the restoration of any of the laws concerning the Jewish state. But there had been issued by Joseph Smith, the prophet. They shall return. They are commanded to return. And now these two groups, the Polish group of the Ashkenazi, in their proclamation, none of them went back. They were burned and incinerated by Hitler. They said, we won't go back. They didn't. The Ashkenazi Jew is not represented in very large form in Jerusalem today as the Oriental Jew. Listen to this. The statement was totally approved and was adopted unanimously, and it remained the majority position until the rise of Hitler. Since then, the Reform stance on Zionism has undergone a radical change because 6 million of the Ashkenazi were destroyed. Those who subscribed to the Pittsburgh and the Hamburg Proclamation. If you ever ask, why did the Lord allow it? Because perhaps the people said, we will not return when all the arrangements after nearly 2,000 years had been made for their restoration and the land dedicated for their return. At the Columbus Convention in 1937, they affirmed the obligation, finally, after the rise of Hitler, of all Jewry, all the Jews, to aid in the upbuilding of Palestine as a Jewish homeland, and by endeavoring to make it not only a haven for refuge for the oppressed, but a center of Jewish culture and spiritual life. The religious element had nearly destroyed one-third of all the Jewish population of the world. the adversary had achieved a great victory. There was a very interesting person in the church who, after the return of the group who were sent over about 1873 by the First Presidency to dedicate the land again, because nothing was happening, not too much. But after Orson Hyde was there, in Russia, of all places, is when they really began to the alliance, the return. And so the returns began in the 1850s and then in the 1860s, and then Herschel was born, and then in the great, huge Zionist movement that occurred in Switzerland at Basel, and Herschel then established the great Zionist movement. The things were in motion, greatly in motion. But the church again went back and sent over some authorities and church authorities and rededicated the land, and they were talking so much about it after 1873 that one young man said, well, if it ever really happens, then I'll know that the restoration and the whole thing is true. And then there was an event that happened in 1919 and 1920. These two things will be of interest to you. By 1914, there had been 90,000 Jews restored to Palestine. Remember Orson Hyde, when he was there, there was still less than 5. And then by 1914, things were happening in Britain. Belfar, the British Foreign Secretary, and Lord Rothschild, Jewish, on November the 2nd, 1970, declared, His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. 1970, in December, a Jewish general, Allenby, enters the city of Jerusalem and conquers it. At that time, there was 55,000 people. Jews back. Then that next year, there was the San Remo Proclamation of 1920, the instrument of British and international policy. As a result, 300,000 Jews had resettled in Palestine in a short period of time. By 1935, they were expanding greatly, and then the Arab resistance began. And of course, through 1936 and 39, you know the details. But in 1920, in Jerusalem, when the San Remo was announced, there was a tremendous riot in Jerusalem. And this young man had been in Jerusalem that day, and just about a block away from where the riots took place, so he could know exactly what was happening when the Arabs tried to resist the return of the Jews and the whole homeland concept of the Jews had been established. He realized that the restoration had not only begun to occur, it was going to be certain, and that man was David O. McKay. And now, of course, today, the Jews have been restored. On November the 27th in the evening, a man by the name of Dr. Sukinik. His son was the first Jewish general and head of the Haganah, chief of staff of the first Jewish state. Dr. Sukinik had just seen the Dead Sea Scrolls for the first time 3 days before. He smuggled himself across barbed wire into Bethlehem to try to get some of the scrolls. And that night, in that November day, he realized the scrolls had great significance for the Jewish people. But that night also, the United Nations declared Israel a state, for the first time in over 1900 years. And his own son was chief of staff. If he had been captured by the Arabs, what a hostage he would have been. I think when Yagidi Din, his son, found out what his father had done, he must have went through all kinds of roofs. But Yagidi Din was to join his father. And Yagidi Din must make a great series of discoveries. One discovery he made was a document that had the signature of the last prime minister of Israel on it before he was killed by the Romans, and he showed it for the first time to Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of the new Israel state. And on the document was the signature of the last Jewish general. And that document had been found by the first Jewish general 1900 years later. And in the document was a deed signed by a man called Alma, confirming the Hebrew origin of the name Alma. You don't know it, but there's been much written against the church for our naivety in believing Joseph Smith. We all know that Alma Mater means fostering mother. Where did Joseph Smith ever get Alma for a Hebrew name? And in the documents found by Yagidi Din, the general, there was a deed given by Alma, the son of Judah, a deed to that ancient Jewish general. Then in 1967, another scroll was presented by Kondo. I know Kondo personally. He wanted $1.5 million for it because the first four scrolls found in 1945 sold for $250,000. This was the longest of all the scrolls, a tremendous scroll. Kondo wanted $1.5 million for it. During the Six-Day War, Yagidi Din, the general, put him under house arrest and shipped him out to Tel Aviv. And when the war was over, 6 days later, the general had the scroll, and Kondo had his freedom. Kondo never said what he got for the scroll, and the generals never said either. There may be 7 other scrolls involved. 4 days later, and I have the account of the general and a number of tapes by him, I read in Jerusalem about 3 years ago, what happened. 4 days later, the general unrolled the scroll. It was 29 feet long, the longest of all the scrolls. And as he began to translate the first part of the scroll, it dealt with the deployment of troops in the last days as they had just deployed the troops in the Six-Day War. And the censors would not let him publish for 8 years. It's still not published. And that was 11 years ago. Hopefully it'll be out this year. But the last part of the scroll was stunning also in what it had. Because it dealt with a temple. And there's a whole corpus of material that deals with a place called New Jerusalem and a temple that will be built in New Jerusalem that will have a high wall named after, with 12 gates named after the 12 apostles. After the 12 tribes. And Joseph Smith had a vision that there would be a place called New Jerusalem and a temple would be built there with courts and there would be a high wall with 12 gates named after the 12 tribes. Yogita Din was at BYU a year ago. He came to talk on Masada, where other scrolls were found in an excavation there, and he found that many of them were interested in what he had to say about the scroll. And I think that he now knows where New Jerusalem is. The temple to be built in Old Jerusalem is described in Ezekiel. It's not the temple described in the Dead Sea Scroll. The Dead Sea Scroll is actually written in the first vernacular, the first person. It's a commandment by God to build a temple in a place called New Jerusalem. These are the things that are happening in the world. I find them rather interesting and exciting. And I hope that I've stimulated your interest to study your own scriptures, to learn more, to frequently go to the Spirit, increase your testimony, enriching your lives by all of the tremendous things that the prophet Joseph Smith has prepared and provided for us. He gave us a legacy of 1,800 pages of writings and standard works and scriptures, most of which now can be confirmed in detail in unique ways and fashions from the new discoveries. And he said that they will make the discoveries, and in fact there will be an avalanche of discoveries made in the future. All I'm telling you about now is the trickle. There are going to be fabulous things found because worldwide now all the scholars are getting familiar with our doctrines. Dr. Molin of the Dead Sea Scrolls, quoted by Nibley in the reprinted book he just put out on an approach to the Book of Mormon. A monk in Austria, the Catholic Church, he says, you might as well call the people of the Dead Sea Scrolls Latter-day Saints and be done with it. It's a grudging concession. Nibley had that in the priesthood manual 21 years ago, but most of us don't read enough of that kind of material, but it was there. And then Dr. Jean de Ressay, who was one of the first to know and could read the Nag Hammadi discoveries. In France today, he has all of our standard works. He knows that we, for some reason or other, have had all of this thunder, and we've been rolling it across the world gradually for 146 years. Men are becoming familiar with our semantics, our detail of certain words, the turns of phrases, and the specificity of doctrine, organization, and practice that we have always believed. I hope you do more than just believe. We have known to be true because a prophet, Joseph Smith, restored it to us. And each of you should get your own testimony of that and keep it. In the name of Christ, amen. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to stay a few more minutes. My plane leaves in about 2 hours. I know you're tired. I've enjoyed sharing this thing with you. Yes. The second lesson, the first one is a prophet has come. Second one, he has seen the Messiah. And the third one, the Messiah is Jesus Christ. And then they go along pretty much the regular lessons that we have today. Any other questions any of you might have? We've been here a long time. Yes? This tape will be made available. In fact, one of the reasons you've seen so much paraphernalia and things happening is because the material I've given tonight, some of it I've never given before. And therefore, they wanted to tape it, so we taped it, and there'll be at least two tapes, I guess, and it will be available through Sema Valley, and then there'll be one here from Stan Harding's group as well. Yes? You're wrong. In the ancient text I could quote from, and I haven't got time, and we want to have a closing prayer or two before very many of you leave, it says in one of these that Elohim is the Father of Jesus Christ. And then in discussing it, the only reason why the plural is used is because of the title. You have to get a superlative. And so Elohim is for the great God, the God of all the gods. And then the Doctrine and Covenants says he is the great God of all the gods and called forth a council of the gods. And Mother's name, I don't know what it is. And for reasons, perhaps. Let's have a closing prayer then. There was actually a movement by modernized Jews to assimilate and to take their identity and remove it. The Pittsburgh Platform of 1883
After 1900 years of the Passover expressions, next year in Jerusalem, now they were going to remove it, forget it. After 1900 years of suffering, there was religious differentiation occurring among the Jews themselves, a fragmentation, right at the moment when the power and the authority and the command from deity had said, return. And all the provisions for that return were being laid, and they would return. And yet they were willing to throw overboard nearly everything that in the past had given substance and sustenance and content under all the duress for all those years. Even languages were abandoned. Jewish mannerisms were carefully brought under control. The Jewish apparel was discarded. The traditional Jewish fashion of wearing one's beard and hair was given up. The ghetto was evacuated, and the study of the law was discontinued. And for this, the Gentile equivalents were substituted. In addition, Gentile occupations which were formerly closed to the Jews were eagerly adopted. From 1819, at the time of the Hamburg Proclamation, from that moment that the adversary could see what was going to happen with the Great Restoration, he was moving to try to eliminate the situation among the Jews. Rabbi Isaac N. Wise in 1819 did more for establishing the Reformed Judaism in America than any other Jewish spiritual leader, and stated in 1854 that one of the basic principles of Reform was that whatever makes us ridiculous before the world as it now is may safely and should be abolished. They were ceasing to pray for their return. Now the Reform movement had its disaster, of course. In certain divine ordained punishments, it appears, the Jews were in exile and dispersion, which was a part of the divine scheme of things. But many had lost that vision. And in 1871, at the Augsburg Synod of Reform rabbis from Germany, Austria, Galicia, Hungary, Switzerland, a total of 52 delegates stated that the old Jewish political existence had passed away altogether and that the Jews were incorporated into modern personality. In 1860, the American Reform rabbi Samuel Adler stated that the first and most important step for such a Reform congregation is to free its service of shocking lies. Petition for the restoration of a sacrificial cult and return to Jerusalem? Forget it, is what they were saying. He says in the 1885 Pittsburgh platform again, "We consider ourselves no longer a nation, and therefore expect neither a return to Palestine nor a sacrificial worship under the sons of Aaron, nor the restoration of any of the laws." And in 1907, David Philipson, historian of the Jewish Reform Movement, summarized the position of the Reform point as of view as follows. "If the Reform Movement teaches anything clearly, it is a repudiation of the political and national aspects of traditional Judaism, and the clear declaration that Judaism is now a religion with a religious mission only." How wrong. Therefore, there was an outright rejection of all historical and emotional connection with Zion. And then, in 1841, and this is interesting, the Reformed Temple in Charleston, North Carolina, on March the 29th, "This country is our Palestine," they said. "This city named Charleston is our Jerusalem. This house of God is our temple." Even the American Jews in a certain Reform movement were likewise subscribing to the same feeling. In accordance with these sentiments, resolutions were passed by several Reform conferences to the effect that all references to the return to Zion and to the messianic hope, to the rebuilding of the Temple of Jerusalem, and to the Jewish peoplehood must be excised and removed from the prayer book printed for and used by the congregations. In London, 1903, all petitions for a return to Palestine and a restoration of a Jewish state and reinstitution for sacrificial work was excluded. Do you get the picture? But there was also at the same time a rise of Zionism right after 1843 with the newly increased interest in their history in Russia. Of all places, the Aliyahs, the return, began. Whole groups of people sensed an impelment beyond all history. Within 2 years, the dedication by Orson Hyde. And within a decade, Russians were preparing to purchase and acquire land in Palestine and did return to start taking muddy, swampy areas and turn them into productive areas to survive. A great impelment in other countries among Jewish elements also occurred. And the first Zionist Congress finally met in 1897 in Switzerland, and the Central Conference of the American Rabbis as well. At the same time as these meetings were going on, the American Reform Movement declared its total disapproval of any attempt to establish a Jewish state. Likewise, the German and the Polish reform movement stated likewise. And then this statement was adopted unanimously, and it remained the majority position in the reform movement until the rise of Hitler. At the Columbus Convention in America in 1937, the reform movement affirmed the obligation. Note the turnaround now, 1937, because something had happened in Europe. They reaffirmed, contrary to all their 100 years of reform activity, the obligation now of all Jewry to aid in the upbuilding of Palestine as a Jewish homeland by endeavoring to make it not only a haven of refuge for the oppressed, but a center of Jewish culture and spiritual life. The Jews were divided throughout the world into at least three groups: the Oriental Jews, the Sephardic group who had mostly gone into Spain and then back into Turkey, been driven in different places and several other places then, and then the Ashkenazi Jews, the European Jews. In 1833-34 came the Nuremberg Proclamation of the Nazis. By 1944, 6 million Jews had been killed. The reform movement said, "We're not going back to Jerusalem," and they didn't go back. Most of the Ashkenazi Jews were murdered by Hitler. Most of those who subscribed in Europe to the reform movement did not go back to Jerusalem. Most of those who returned to Jerusalem were the Oriental Jews in particular, and a few of the Sephardic, and not many of the Ashkenazi. Except those who had already, by impelment, began under the Russian Elias. Under the prophet Joseph Smith, the great and positive declarations and actual commands issued to all the nations of the world was for all the Jews to return. In 1830, the interest in the return of the Jews of Palestine was being kept alive by only a few Jews, perhaps mostly by Christians. And then the teachings and announcements of the prophet and the 1845 declaration after his death. By 1873, the first agricultural settlements were established in Palestine and doing well, mostly by Russian Jews. They called themselves the Lovers of Zion, and then Theodore Herzl, whose brilliant gift enabled him to make a significant contribution, the one most instrumental in the development of political Zionism. He was profoundly distressed by the anti-Semitism after the Dreyfus Affair in France, and although he preferred assimilation for the Jews, he became a subscriber originally to the Reform Movement. He felt that a return to Israel was, however, the only guarantee of national survival, and it was true. Those who did not follow through and exercise that desire to return to Jerusalem did not survive, and many innocents with them. The first Zionist Congress was convened in 1897 in Switzerland. In 1904, Herzl was dead, but having made his great contribution, the Zionist movement gained impetus by the growth of Jewish settlements in Palestine to the political movements. The Zionists had now increased, and by 1914, 90,000 had returned to Palestine. The political Zionists insisted that the granting of a charter was an essential prerequisite for colonization. This opportunity was prepared by World War I, the famous Balfour Declaration. This was a letter written by Arthur J. Balfour, British Foreign Secretary, to Lord Rothschild in November 2, 1917. His Majesty government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national homeland for the Jewish people. This became an official declaration November the 9th, 1917. In December, a Jewish General Allenby entered the city. There are now 55,000 Jews in Jerusalem. In June Conference 1918, there was a Central Conference of American Rabbis. It comes under the active area for the Reform Movement. Then, after the British mandate was provided following World War I, there was convened in Paris a conference in opposition to the return of the Jews in a homeland in Jerusalem. In 1920 was the San Remo Pact. This became the instrument of the British international policy. It was endorsed by Allied powers. The agreement of the San Remo permitted 300,000 Jews to immigrate and settle in Palestine. This created massive problems, of course, and this is when the disturbance and the confrontation of the Arabs began. There was a young individual about the turn of the century who was a Mormon. He kept hearing what was going on. And there was also the announcement in 1873 of another group of Mormon leaders who had gone to Jerusalem and rededicated the land for the Jews. Things weren't moving fast enough, and so another group of apostles had gone there to rededicate it. When they returned, sacrament meetings and different meetings and conferences, much talk again about the return of the Jews. He then said to himself, if such return really occurs, then he'll know the church is really true. He happened to be in Israel in 1920, and about that time, the San Remo Pact was announced. Just two blocks away from his hotel, there was a massive riot that occurred when the Arabs, realizing now that there was going to be a possible state for Israel, the possibility of a refuge for the Jews, created a massive, undesirable situation. Men were killed, and this young Mormon man barely probably escaped involvement in that riot. He was David O. McKay. At the end of 1935, tremendous settlements had occurred throughout Palestine. Already 2 years of destruction had occurred in Nazi Germany, and those who subscribed to the Hamburg Proclamation and the Pittsburgh Platform were already undergoing great persecution. But in Palestine, the Arabs were resisting Zionism. And in fact, since 1828, a whole series of events had occurred where the Arabs and the Jews were in constant confrontation, particularly during 1936 to 1939. To reduce the strife, the British issued the White Paper of May 17, 1939, limiting Jewish immigration to Palestine. Then the storm broke, and other groups of Jewish people were organized, including the Haganah. And the head of the Haganah supporting Jews returned was Yagil Yadin, one of the first Jewish generals and head of the and chief of staff, Israeli armies, who became an expert in the Dead Sea Scrolls. World War II atrocities gave renewed impetus to Zionism. There was great violence in Palestine in 1944. Police headquarters were blown up by the Jews. 1946, the King David Hotel, the Haganah, and others were moving towards a confrontation with the world at large. The British turned the problem finally to the United Nations. On the 23rd of November at Lake Success, they were unable to come to a decision to establish a Jewish state. 6 days later, November the 29th, 1947, the United Nations called for a partition of the area into a Jewish and Arab state. Linked in an economic union, Jerusalem was to be an international enclave under United Nations control. The plan was rejected by the Arabs. There was confusion, a great deal of insurrection for the next 6 months. Then the British mandate over the country was formally terminated May the 15th, 1948, and the Jews proclaimed the establishment of a sovereign state the previous day. Battles flared. Seven Arab nations declared war, and then with the United Nations mediating, an uneasy truce was declared. Israel was admitted as a nation to the confrontation of the United Nations on May the 11th, 1949. A year later, ceasefire occurred. An uneasy truce and reoccurring wars has occurred throughout all the rest of the years that followed. And unrest increased in 1952. 1956, Israel, Britain, and France invaded Egypt in the famous 100-hour war, the Suez Crisis, which created some of the problems associated with the Nag Hammadi documents. There was the assassination of the Prime Minister of Egypt. And because of the 100-hour war, which involved the British and the French were depossessed from Egypt, where they had been since 1912, the time of Napoleon. Another uneasy peace occurred, which lasted in 1967. And then we had the 1967 war, and Jerusalem was regained by the Jews. And then, of course, the October War a few years later. These were preparatory wars. Do Revelation state that there will be agitation until the Jews lay the cities of Egypt waste and conquer from the Nile to Damascus? And then they'll be able to be reinstated and rebuild their temples? Yes, they do, to some extent. And Section 124 of the Doctrine and Covenants implies that a temple where ordinances will be built for a house of the Lord will be constructed in Jerusalem. About 1973, the president of the church, Harold B. Lee, went to Jerusalem. There had been a small period of time when missionaries were active in Lebanon and Jerusalem about 30 years ago, but there had been little official church capacity in Israel. There, the president of the church established in Jerusalem a branch with Dr. Galbraith and Twetness in the branch presidency, and the commission was given to get the Book of Mormon into Hebrew, to get the testimony of the prophet Joseph Smith into Hebrew, and to get and obtain an information center for the church, so that the church then could take a more positive role in the Jewish movement and fulfill its own prophetic destiny. In October 1976, just before conference, President Kimball stated that the time for the Jews had arrived, and the preparation for the work and the material and the gospel to be taken to them had arrived. A Jewish convert in Las Vegas, who I know personally, was told in his patriarchal blessing about 15 years ago that he would be the one who would prepare the material for taking the gospel to the Jews. He was called to be a chairman of a committee, having moved to Salt Lake City, and he finished that work in October 1977. Within a short few months, the lesson material for taking the gospel to the Jews had been compiled and completed and was started to be used in San Diego and moved on up to Newhall, California. I have a copy now of the Articles of Faith with the Star of David and the Angel of Moroni on it. It's interesting to examine the lesson material. In summary, one might say it's composed of the first lesson, the prophet has come. Second, he has seen the Messiah. Third lesson, the Messiah is Jesus Christ. So the movement among the Jews is beginning on with extraordinary impetus. There are many hundreds of Jews that went through the temple in Washington, D.C., and through the great things that were provided in New York, the exposition. It's not legal to proselyte in Jerusalem, but it's one of the greatest areas of freedom, nevertheless. But because of the referrals obtained, many Jews in Palestine can be contacted. Even in Jerusalem today, there are 32 different sects. Which one is right? When they all came back from the dispersion, they all came back with different ideas and historical backgrounds. Twentness took the prayer of Orson Hyde. He put it on a beautiful parchment about the size of a normal scroll of Jewish material and scripture and canon. He put it in Hebrew and English and took it to Teddy Kollek, who was on the ministerial level and who was the Jewish mayor of Jerusalem, one of the first in 1900 years. What an office to occupy. Can you imagine every year, 1900 years, someone in a family saying, next year in Jerusalem, and then a young male member of that family becomes the mayor of Jerusalem after the restoration? How great. At any rate, Twentness laid this document down on the desk of Teddy Kollek, and when he had unrolled it, he took a glimpse of it. He is a huge bear of a man. Twentness is just a little man. And then Teddy Kollek stood up, overwhelming Twentness, who didn't know what to expect. And then Teddy Kollek says, I don't want that. I've got it memorized. Come to find that others besides Teddy Kollek had the prayer of Orson Hyde memorized, and sometimes for as long as 20 years, Ben-Gurion, General Diane, and others. Teddy Kollek asked him, what do you want? Well, the upshot is that beautiful picture on the church news about a year or so ago. A special place had been selected on the Mount of Olives for a memorial to Orson Hyde. In 1975, Howard Hunter was in Jerusalem as areas were made available and plans were prepared for a memorial in Hebrew and in English commemorating the dedication of the land of the Jews for the return. And what was finally concluded was that a beautiful 5-acre plot of land on the Mount of Olives, very near where he must have made that altar and gave that dedicatory prayer, has been selected. It'll be dedicated. In fact, it was dedicated on the 30th anniversary of the return of the Jews. It was going to be dedicated the previous fall, but because of the Jewish interest and their sympathies toward Mormonism and vice versa, and beautiful things that have been going on in Jerusalem, the Jewish government asked the LDS Church not dedicate the land for the Orson Hyde Memorial, but rather wait and join with them in the 30th anniversary in May 1978. I have walked in that very vicinity and marveled at the circumstances surrounding the return of the Jews. I know many Jewish people in my particular work. I visited recently with some of them, and I'm constantly interested in their feelings about what's been happening worldwide. It is fascinating to realize that among them, they feel an inner impelment. Things are going on. They can't resist. The world can't resist it. No matter what happens, nationally or otherwise, no matter how the efforts of Hitler in actually massacring nearly one-third of the total Jewish world population during that great war, no matter what has been instrumental in trying to thwart their purposes, the Jews are now back in Jerusalem, nearly 4 million strong. Almost one-fourth of the total world population of Jews are back home. The restoration has occurred. References in testimonies and in the Book of Mormon, all of these things now go back to that marvelous little grove and the young boy, Joseph Smith. The quandary is now over. There is a church filled with authority and power, ministering to the world at large. Glorious it is to be a member of that church, which embraces so comprehensively everything in the way of knowledge, national movements, governments, unforeseen things, unpredicted, but prophesied, except prophetically. And with it all, of course, is the great terror that stimulated the Columbus Conference in 1937 here in America. They affirmed the obligation at that time, the Reform Movement, that all Jewry was to aid in the upbuilding of Palestine as a Jewish homeland by endeavoring to make it not only a haven of refuge for the oppressed, but a center of Jewish cultural and spiritual life. Now the great Hebrew University and the great symphonies are beginning that movement of endeavor. But if we go back to that one little document that had been put out by the prophets and the others, it stated in 1845 they would return. They would reengage themselves with their own judges, their own government, their own offices, and fulfill all the things in their reinstatement in their role as a restored Israel, preparatory to receiving the gospel and the coming of the Messiah. These events, then, that are yet to transpire are prophetically laid out in the Book of Mormon, in the Doctrine and Covenants. 1,600 prophecies, more or less, were provided by the prophet Joseph Smith. Many of these have been fulfilled. A number of them apply directly to the Jews and their immediate future and the temples that will be built there. The restoration of the Jews is just one example, and their return, that there is a prophet in the land, and a restoration of all powers and authority. And may each individual look into his own heart and examine the evidences that have been provided, both historically, but resident in the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, more than 140 years ago. What do the Israelis really think about the Mormons? That might be hard to answer in detail, but here, published in the Jerusalem Post a year or two ago in July, we have these words. In the history of the Zionist movement, there have been several groups of non-Jewish supporters, among them the Mormons. This was made by a major Israeli newspaper. It was on the front page and written by Larry Lefkowitz for the Jerusalem Post. The Mormons, or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as they call themselves, are a Christian sect in that they believe in the divinity of Jesus. But their history began, as they see it, in biblical times, even though it centers on events which took place in America, where their prophet and founder, Joseph Smith, was born, lived, and died. They believe that an Israelite named Lehi sailed with other Israelites from Palestine to South America some 2,500 years ago in the reign of King Zedekiah and became the ancestors of the Incas in 1820. The angel appeared to Joseph Smith, showing him where the records of the Book of Mormon were, and he translated them into English. This article goes on to say, under Joseph Smith's guidance, the Mormon community grew in numbers despite persecution by non-Mormons, at first because of its claim of exclusive truth and departure from its traditional Christian doctrine, later because of its advocacy of polygamous marriages, an article of faith subsequently abandoned. The persecutions, including the murder of Joseph Smith, forced a migration in 1846 to their Zion in Utah, where they have since prospered. Modeling many of their practices on the Old Testament, they claim descent from the tribe of Ephraim. On arrival in Utah, the Mormons named the river they found there Jordan, as it flowed into the Great Salt Lake from a freshwater lake, which seemed to them counterparts of the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee, and the River Jordan, a topography deemed more than coincidental. There they established cooperative agricultural settlements, as Jewish Zionists were to do in Israel some decades later. Mormons support Zionism in the sense of urging a return of the Jews to rebuild Palestine was theologically inspired. The Book of Mormon, in Old Testament-like language, prophesied the Jewish return. And this article quotes from the Book of Mormon, "I will remember the covenant which I have made with my people, and I have covenanted with them that I will gather them together in mine own time, that I will give unto them again the land of their fathers for their inheritance, which is the land of Jerusalem, which is the promised land unto them forever, saith the Father." Joseph Smith saw the restoration of the Jews to their land as an event that must precede the coming of the Messiah and their conversion. Not content merely to preach this doctrine, he sent Orson Hyde, a church elder, to Palestine in 1841 to dedicate the land for the return of the Jews. Once there, Orson ascended the Mount of Olives, prayed to God to remove the barrenness and sterility of the land and let springs of living water break forth to water its thirsty soil, to let the land become abundantly fruitful when possessed by its rightful heirs. In a letter to church leaders 75 years before the Balfour Declaration, Hyde wrote, "It was by a political power and influence that the Jewish nation was broken down and her subjects dispersed abroad. I will hazard the opinion that by political power and influence they will be gathered and built up, and further that England is destined in the wisdom and economy of heaven to stretch forth the arm of political power and advance in the front ranks of this glorious enterprise." So completely fulfilled. After Joseph Smith's death, says the article, Mormons continue to be interested in the subject. 30 years after the first mission to Palestine, a second mission was dispatched in 1873, and again charged with dedicating the land for the return of the Jews. It also held a dedication ceremony on the Mount of Olives. One of the members, George A. Smith, wrote back to Mormon officials March the 4th at 10 a.m. We received a visit from Abraham Ashkenazi, chief rabbi in Jerusalem. We understand he is selected by the Turkish Sultan and received some titular offers from him. They express a firm faith in redemption of Israel and the return of the 10 tribes. They say there's no springs here now, but used to be in the days of Israel's prosperity, and there will be again. Rainwater is now their only supply, and later in the season it sells at a farthing a bottle. Europeans have been boring for water, but unsuccessfully. It has not been time for it. The interview was very pleasant and interesting. The rabbi and three of their principal men who accompanied them appeared to be men of intelligence. Mormon publications reported on Jewish settlement in Palestine in the years following. Jerusalem is rebuilding rapidly. Palestine resounds to the hum and Hebrew industry. The Mormons from the very beginning felt a kinship with the Jews. Even themselves were persecuted. And the article continues, the attitude of the Mormons as a religious sect has been in strong contrast to the official viewpoint of most Christian denominations. A rather interesting article appears on the Jerusalem Post on the front page, isn't it? Now I have in my hand copies of the testimony of Joseph Smith in Hebrew and also Plan of Salvation. A few years ago, thousands of copies were taken to Jerusalem for distribution. The Book of Mormon has been translated into Hebrew and appears now that it will be translated and made available, published in about another year and a half or so, sometime in late 1980. The work among the Jews has commenced. Prophecy has been fulfilled. Tremendous amount of activity has taken place. And then just a few months ago, Jewish articles have appeared dealing with a controversy to conversion, the liberal movement in Jerusalem, in Europe, in America, and the Zionist movement. They now recognize their own history. They recognize the Holocaust for what it was in certain part. But we as Latter-day Saints recognize also there's been a restoration. The Jews are home. Prophecy has been fulfilled. May we get a testimony of the prophet Joseph Smith and keep it in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.